I don't know what else there is to say other than, man, it's been quite a week, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 26th of June. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. One hates to drag what has been a groundbreaking day down into the minutiae of business and the economy, but that is what we do here, right? Actually, no, it's not. It's not what we do. It's what everybody else does. And for today's installment, you can blame Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon. This afternoon, Senator Wyden announced he is seeking co-sponsors for a bill he is drafting. A bill that would change the tax code. It's going to be called the Marriage Equality for All Taxpayers Act, and it would, in part, get rid of gender-specific references to marriage in the tax code. It's just the tip of the economic iceberg of the ramifications of today's Supreme Court ruling. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us going.
Same-sex couples at the Supreme Court today cheered the court's decision, but the fun will really begin when they start thinking about the financial implications of today's ruling. First, let's talk taxes.
What is a plus is a minus.
Janice Cowie is an attorney and accountant in the LGBT practice at Markham LLP.
Once you're combining your income, you start to lose deductions, you start to lose credits, as well as hit the higher income tax brackets faster.
But lower-income same-sex couples could save money filing as a married couple. Now they can claim their children as dependents. That leads to a higher earned income tax credit. And if your spouse gets benefits through your job, that's not taxed. Bill Moran heads Merrill Lynch's LGBT financial services team. He says right now,
if you work for a corporation and they offer domestic partner benefits, you're taxed on the benefits that your partner gets.
But here's the thing. Moran says corporations have already started phasing out domestic partner benefits in states that recognize same-sex marriage. It happened to Megan Morey in Washington, D.C. She now works as an attorney at the National LGBTQ Task Force. But before she got that job, she depended on her partner's employer for benefits until same-sex marriage was legalized in D.C.
They said, you know, it just doesn't make legal or financial sense for us anymore to be providing domestic partnership benefits.
Morey ended up on Medicaid, and she thinks that'll happen to other unmarried same-sex partners as more employers phase out domestic partner benefits. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Lots more to talk about on the aforementioned busy, busy week. Here to do that with us are Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post, Felix Salmon from Reuters, rather from Fusion. He used to be at Reuters. He's at Fusion now. Sorry, guys. Felix, you get to go first then. First of all, how are you both? Sorry about that. How are you both?
I'm happy rainbows. How are you, Kai?
Happy rainbows. That's right. We'll get there in a bit. So, Felix, give me a macroeconomic gut check, if you would. GDP came out this week, a revision to the first quarter. It was down, but not as far down as we thought. Consumer spending is up. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. I feel like there was lots of weird weather in the first quarter. You can't really extrapolate too much. And although I didn't like that figure, this figure's better. We're moving in the right direction. Maybe. I'm not worried.
Catherine?
Yeah, I feel kind of the same way. Job growth has been pretty strong. The projections for next week, then the upcoming jobs report are like 200,000. So seems pretty good.
All right. That, which is more, exactly
as more would be better.
Well, you know. always, right? I mean, well, in jobs anyway. All right. So, Catherine, through the miracle of modern journalism, you have a piece in the paper online, Dateline Athens, yet you are here with us. You're just back, right?
Yeah, I came back a couple
days ago. Okay, so we're going to have Stephen Beard from Athens in a little while. I want a reality check on what you think is going to happen based on your experiences on the ground.
You know, there was honestly a little less panic, at least that was visible to a foreigner, than I had expected. But I think it's kind of this slow rundown exhaustion was more of what I felt while I was there. I mean, if you look at the numbers, people have been pulling their money out of banks for a couple of years now. They're down like 45. Bank deposits are down like 45% since their peak in 2009. So, you know, there's been a lot of drama this past week and last few months, but I think people are just kind of sick of it at this point.
Felix, I saw a tweet earlier this week that said, I can't understand why there's a single dollar left or a single euro left in any Greek bank account.
It's true. They've had more than enough time to take their money out. But the fact is that it's not up to the Greeks, and whether they take their money out or not is really not something the Eurogroup cares about. It's these European finance ministers who can't agree on anything, who keep on setting deadlines and then watching those deadlines whoosh past.
Yeah.
And I think the Greeks and most of the Europeans and everyone else is just fed up at this point. They just want some kind of resolution. And frankly, with the number of years that Greece has been in this horrible depression, any kind of an end to that would have to be better than what they have right now.
I think it's going to be some sort of restructuring or default. It's just inevitable at this point.
Seriously?
If you just,
they can't pay back $150 billion of debt.
To quote you, Catherine, and you were even talking about a smaller amount. You in the paper, there's no way in Hades they'll be able to pay.
No, I mean, they're supposed to pay, what, like 1.6 billion euros back next week?
Right.
And they can't make that. There's no way they can make that without another loan. But then in July, they have like 7 billion. And then in August, another 6 billion. And in September, another 6 billion. So, I mean, if they can't make this by comparison tiny amount next week, there's just no way.
All right. So fish or cut bait here, and then we got to move on. Catherine, do they stay in the Eurozone or do they leave?
That's a good question.
Yes,
I think they want to stay.
But whether they end up staying, I don't know.
Felix,
you're bolder. You're typically bolder. Go ahead.
I'm bolder, but I think ultimately the Europeans are going to be so afraid of the political implications of letting Greece go, they're going to find a way to let them stay.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they can default without leaving the euro, too.
Yes.
Yes, but no. Come on.
Yes, they can. Yes, they will.
How's that going to happen?
They'll just restructure. The Europeans will let them restructure their debt. End of story.
And then we've gone through, what, 5 years of all of this Sturm und Drang, not to throw a German phrase in here, which nobody needs, and it will end up with, yeah, they're going to restructure. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, they've already done it once. They did it in 2012. They can do it again.
Yeah, I mean, there's just no other way that the math can work out without writing down some of that debt.
I can't even handle this anymore. We got to go. Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post and Felix Hammond. He's from Fusion, not Reuters. I apologize. Thanks, you guys. Have yourselves a good weekend.
Thanks, Guy.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. Interestingly enough, given the week in news, not all that much going on Wall Street today. Details, numbers, you know the drill. Don't look now, but it's going to be another boffo weekend at the box office. Ted 2, Jurassic World, and Inside Out are each expected to pull in another $50 million or more. And for those last two, it will be, as I said, another $50 million on top of the multi-millions they've already brought in. So, pity the poor movie studio that's trying to compete with these mega hits, right? Or actually, no, don't bother, because as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports, summer blockbusters have created their own kind of sharing economy.
It's easy to understand how the monster success of Jurassic World is good for Universal, and how Pixar and its parent Disney must be feeling right now about Inside Out.
This is joy.
But it turns out a big movie can also inspire joy in the theater next door. Phil Contrino is the chief analyst for BoxOffice.com.
There are plenty of examples historically where a movie was so massive and the industry was, you know, kind of afraid that, oh, that's going to mean that other movies aren't going to perform well, but the exact opposite happened.
He says movies like Avatar, Frozen, and now Jurassic World have all had a halo effect.
Movies are a product just like anything else, and if customers walk away happy and satisfied with the experience, they're more prone to come back again.
Tom Noonan thinks there's another reason movie going begets movie going. He's a producer and a professor at UCLA's School of Theater, Film, and Television.
What happens, as you probably are aware as a consumer, is sometimes your movie's sold out.
So you check the time, check with your partner, and you go see something else.
Big movies always create more box office all the way around.
Smart marketers, he says, take advantage of that.
They'll own the fact that there are other movies that you can see out there that are really fun and big and exciting, and we just are going to have a sense of humor about it and try to entice you to see us, too.
Melissa McCarthy, a lush green park, maybe spying on dinosaurs? I'd see that. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
We are, as Catherine and Felix and I were talking about just a couple of minutes ago, still on the slippery slope known as the Greek debt crisis. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras calls the latest proposal from his country's creditors blackmail. It's a whole long story about pension reforms and tax revenues, which we will cover in another story some other day. But Tsipras isn't the only one unhappy with the situation. All this week, as I said, our European correspondent Stephen Beard has been bringing us the stories of ordinary Greeks trying to make a living in the middle of a crisis. Today, the Greek economy and its medications.
My name is Yannis Dagres. I am a pharmacist and I own a pharmacy in Athens, Greece.
As he dispenses his pills and powders, Giannis Dagres is counting the primary cost of the crisis, a severe shortage of drugs.
Almost every category of drugs, antibiotics, drugs for high blood pressure, vaccines for children, almost everything.
Supplies are dwindling because the government's been forced to cut spending on healthcare. Dagris says the shortages make him ashamed of Greece.
It's not very healthy and it's embarrassing for a state that claims to be a developed country.
Drug shortages are not the only challenge he's facing. Greece's international creditors want to scrap the pharmacist's current monopoly, which gives them the sole right to sell over-the-counter drugs like aspirin and paracetamol. Supermarkets and other outlets aren't allowed to. The creditors call this blatant protectionism. Pharmacist Lefteris Marinos disputes that.
Protectionism means protecting something, and in this particular case, protecting the health of the Greek people.
A pharmacist should always be on hand to ensure that it's safe for a particular customer to take aspirin, he says. But Nikolaos Haritakis, professor of economics at Athens University, doesn't buy that.
Nonsense. It's a stupidity.
It's pure protectionism.
Totally against the benefits of the society.
It's not just economists saying that. Dr. Dimitrios Papadimitriadis, a psychiatrist and a health economist, agrees that the pharmacy regulations must be loosened and that foreign pharmacy chains, currently banned, should be allowed to operate in Greece.
In my opinion, I think that the patient will be better off if competition was actually working, because the prices will be lower.
At his pharmacy, Giannis Dagres points out that Greece has many more pharmacy shops per capita than all other European countries. He claims that foreign takeovers would cut the number and remote rural areas would suffer. He accuses the creditors of neo-colonialism.
Every time that the foreigners come here, the first thing they say, they want privatizations because they want to come and get our assets. So they want us to work for them as a colony.
But without the creditors' help, Greece could be booted out of the euro. Any new currency would plummet. The cost of imported drugs, and most of them are imported in Greece, would soar. More woe for the pharmacist and his customers. In Athens, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we still don't know which claw machines are the good claw machines and which ones are the evil ones, so it's kind of a crapshoot.
Yeah, most of them, they're the evil ones. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 56 points today, 0.3%, closed at 17,947. The NASDAQ dipped 31 points lower, 0.6%, finished at 5080. The S&P 500 off just a fraction of a point. We'll call it even, 2101. For the week gone by, the 5 days that was, the Dow and the S&P both down 0.4%. The NASDAQ off 0.7% on the week. Nike was a big mover in the Dow. The company reported better than expected profits, saying it's been selling higher margin shoes and clothes at higher prices. That formula is one investors like. Shares sprinted up 4.25%. Micron Technology warned of further declines in the price of chips that are used in personal computers. Shares in the chipmaker tanked to the tune of 18%. Competitors also down, including Intel off 3%. I wanted to get to this in the wrap with Felix and Catherine, but didn't. The Shanghai Composite Index tumbled more than 7% today on fears that its long rally is coming to an end. Chinese firms listed in the U.S. also took a hit. The sports lottery firm 500.com and the social media company YY both off more than 5%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener supported. So to keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at Marketplace.org by June 30th.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Things are quiet in Washington. Congress is out on recess. The National Association of Realtors issues its pending home sales index for May. And 59 years ago, President Eisenhower signed the Federal Aid Highway Act of 1956, funding the construction of thousands of miles of roadway. Think about that when you're stuck in holiday traffic. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We did a series a couple of weeks ago about homelessness in Los Angeles and how the number of people living out in the open, that is, not in any kind of real shelter at all, has more than doubled in the past 2 years. This week, the Los Angeles City Council passed a pair of ordinances that are going to make it easier for police to crack down on some of the homeless encampments that have sprung up around town. They'll be able to seize homeless people's property with 24 hours notice. That's down from 72 hours. The goods will be held for 3 months at the city's impound facility on Skid Row here in downtown. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler went to see what happens when everything gets there.
When city workers impound homeless people's stuff, it ends up here at this warehouse in downtown Los Angeles. It's kept on shelves in a corner behind a locked gate.
We store the property, we keep it safe and clean. For whatever it is and whoever it belongs to, it's important to them. So we treat it as such.
That's Alex Connedy, the facility's project manager. He's sympathetic to the transient nature of life on the streets and the impact it has on people's possessions.
If a person has to go and take care of some business, they're homeless. They have a doctor's appointment, they have a job interview, they have to leave periodically from time to time, and they have nowhere to store their property. When they come back, that property is sometimes not there for whatever reason.
It may have been stolen, but if city workers confiscate property, they leave a notice informing owners that their belongings are being stored here and giving them 90 days to reclaim it. A lot of the impounded stuff is not what I'd expect to see abandoned.
There is an edger for cutting the lawn. There are 20 to 30 bicycles, some of them pretty good-looking bikes. There's a wheelchair.
Few people ever claim their belongings. Since the beginning of the year, Connedy says around 20 people have come here to get their stuff. And there isn't as much confiscated property as I expected, though that may change now that the city is getting more aggressive about cleaning up homeless encampments. Most of the warehouse is taken up by a different kind of storage. In one neat row after another, there are more than 1,460-gallon plastic bins.
They're called bins, but they look like garbage cans, basically.
They're actually clean, sanitized. We call them bins because they're not utilized as trash cans. They're utilized as safe storage bins.
A program called The Bin allows homeless people like 43-year-old Chris Rodriguez to use the storage bins for free.
Anywhere else, you got to pay, what, $60, $70 for a storage.
His wife, Monica, says they keep clean clothes in their bin, but they also use it as a kind of safety deposit box.
Because our stuff isn't just junk. It's our important papers, like Social Security papers, our legal documents.
Many of the people I speak with are dropping off belongings before going to work. That's one of the most surprising things about my visit, the importance of storage in relation to finding or keeping a job. The facility is run by a nonprofit called Chrysalis. Emily Chin is its operations manager.
Many of the clients have to use the service to keep their jobs so they have somewhere to store their property so they can go to work every day.
That describes a guy who only gives me his first name, Giuliano. He's close to being able to move off the streets.
I have a job. I just don't get enough hours to afford my own place. They're talking about a promotion. That would give me more time. And if I get that promotion, then I can afford a place. So I do have a plan.
And what kind of a job is it?
I'm a team member at Jack in the Box.
Alex Connedy sees some clients every day.
Good morning, Silas. How you doing, man? What's going on with you today?
I need to drop my stuff into my bin.
57-year-old Silas Loveless is a big man who laughs easily. He's studying to get his commercial license to drive a big rig.
How much longer you got on your course, your driving training?
I got 3 more classes.
For the better part of a year, Silas has been taking truck driving classes, which cost $150 a month. He only collects $221 a month in government assistance. So Silas has had to rely on food stamps, and he sleeps at a homeless shelter. I ask what happens if he fails his driving test.
Each time if you fail, it's $30 a pop to retest. And I don't have $30, so that's not an option.
He says truck drivers make around $700 a week. Silas considers that enough money to live like a king. At the very least, he'd be able to afford his own place where he could store his stuff in something other than a sanitized garbage bin. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
There you are with your kids, or maybe just by yourself too, that's all right, waiting to be seated at a restaurant or at an arcade or something, and you kill some time trying to win a stuffed animal in one of those claw machine games. And of course, you almost never win because those things are fixed. They are fixed. I tell you, Phil Edwards wrote about it for Vox. Phil, thanks a lot for coming on.
Good to be here.
This falls squarely in the category of, I knew it! I knew these things were rigged. How did you find out? How'd you prove it?
Well, I have been a zealous claw machine player all of my life, and that led me to want to look up some of the instruction manuals. And it actually didn't require very thorough investigative work, because a lot of the manufacturers put it up right there on the internet.
Wow.
That claw machines are easily programmable and that they can be programmed to maximize profit for the vendor.
All right, get me to the nitty-gritty. How are they stealing my money?
So when I started this, I thought that claw machines were rigged in a couple of ways. I thought that maybe these stuffed animals were packed really tightly, or that the claw simply didn't work at all. But it turns out that it's a lot more insidious than that.
Hmm.
What they can regulate is the claw strength. So every time that the claw reaches down and you try to grab an animal,
There
you have the ability to program in the voltage that will be given to the claw.
No way.
So a lot of the times, only one out of 24 times, will that claw be strong enough to actually grab the animal. And then after that, it gets even worse, because they can also program in the dropping skill, which means that they'll give you a chance to grab the animal.
Yeah.
The animal will float up. You'll think that you have victory in your hands.
Of course, of course.
And then it'll drop it before it gets to the prize chute, and you put in another 50 cents
of course
and feel
you
like
do.
You
yeah.
have to try again.
I am going to reveal myself to be a total rube here, and while I suspected a little bit that they were rigged, I sort of thought I had an honest chance to win a panda bear.
I did too. People thought that I was naive, and I had a suspicion that there were just bad claw machines
that
didn't work well, but I didn't think that they were rigged so precisely to maximize the profit.
They can also do it so that you only win like X number of times played, right? There's a whole thing about that.
Yeah, and basically what they can do is they can ensure that the claw will only get high power a certain percentage of the time, and in turn they'll make sure that you can't guess when the claw will get that high power. They randomize it over a set of games. So that means that you can't just stand there waiting for the one time when the claw machine will have full power, because it's randomized. So it's a very smart program that's trying to manipulate you as delicately as possible into spending money.
50 cents at a time.
Yes.
Since you ran this video on Vox, the manuals have been taken down, right?
It's been very interesting to see the responses. Some of the manuals have disappeared from the websites. Other responses have come from like industry publications that have raised some objections to the article that I think are worth saying. They say that a lot of claw machine owners self-police, and It is true that there could be a kind-hearted claw machine owner who wants his claw machine to have a really good reputation in the community. However, the problem is that we still don't know which claw machines are claw machines and which ones are the evil ones. So it's kind of a crapshoot.
Now here's the $64,000 question. Knowing what you know now, are you still going to play?
Oh, I already have. Since I've written it, I've already spent $1 in those things. And now I have the added benefit that every time somebody wins a claw machine prize, they let me know immediately. So,
Phil Edwards, he's a reporter at Vox. Phil, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. This final note on the way out today, and I honestly can't decide whether this is global business at its cynical and most pandering worst or honest corporate expressions of sincere congratulations. But American companies wasted no time today changing their logos to the now familiar rainbow flag of the gay rights movement. Uber, American Airlines, Macy's, and a whole bunch more changed their logos on their Twitter accounts to rainbowed versions. Even Twitter did, too, in point of fact. The winner, by popular consensus in my timeline anyway, was Chipotle with a rainbow burrito and the tagline, Homo Estas? Like I said, quite a week. The Dow up 56 points today, 0.3%. The NASDAQ down 31 points, 0.6%. The S&P 500 off just a fraction. We'll call it pretty much even there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. Tommy Andres is the acting senior producer. Special thanks to Patty Hirsch for stepping in this week and helping us out. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back on Monday live from Aspen, Colorado, the Aspen Ideas Festival up there. We'll see you then. Otherwise, have a good weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.